This is tape one, side one. Century of Light, prepared under the supervision of the Universal House of Justice. Baha'i World Center, 2001. This tape has been prepared by the Baha'i Service for the Blind, a committee of the National Spiritual Assembly of the Baha'is of the United States, May 2001, and your reader is Bill Perry. This tape has been tone indexed. A single tone is given at the beginning of each page number, and a double tone is given at the beginning of each chapter. Forward. The conclusion of the 20th century provides Baha'is with a unique vantage point. During the past 100 years, our world underwent changes far more profound than any in its preceding history, changes that are, for the most part, little understood by the present generation. These same 100 years saw the Baha'i cause emerge from obscurity, demonstrating on a global scale the unifying power with which its divine origin has endowed it. As the century drew to its close, the convergence of these two historical developments became increasingly apparent. Century of Light, prepared under our supervision, reviews these two processes and the relationship between them in the context of the Baha'i teachings. We commend it to the thoughtful study of the Friends in the confidence that the perspectives it opens up will prove both spiritually enriching and of practical help in sharing with others the challenging implications of the revelation brought by Baha'u'llah. The Universal House of Justice, Nowruz, 158 BE. Century of Light. The 20th century, the most turbulent in the history of the human race, has reached its end. Dismayed by the deepening moral and social chaos that marked its course, the generality of the world's peoples are eager to leave behind them the memories of the suffering that these decades brought with them. No matter how frail the foundations of confidence in the future may seem, no matter how great the dangers looming on the horizon, humanity appears desperate to believe that, through some fortuitous conjunction of circumstances, it will nevertheless be possible to bend the conditions of human life into conformity with prevailing human desires. In the light of the teachings of Baha'u'llah, such hopes are not merely illusory, but miss entirely the nature and meaning of the great turning point through which our world has passed in these crucial 100 years. Only as humanity comes to understand the implications of what occurred during this period of history will it be able to meet the challenges that lie ahead. The value of the contribution we as Baha'is can make to the process demands that we ourselves grasp the significance of the historical transformation wrought by the 20th century. What makes this insight possible for us is the light shed by the rising sun of Baha'u'llah's revelation and the influence it has come to exercise in human affairs. It is this opportunity that the following pages address. Page 1, Chapter 1. Let us acknowledge at the outset the magnitude of the ruin that the human race has brought upon itself during the period of history under review. The loss of life alone has been beyond counting. The disintegration of basic institutions of social order, the violation, indeed, the abandonment of standards of decency, the betrayal of the life of the mind through surrender to ideologies as squalid as they have been empty, the invention and deployment of monstrous weapons of mass annihilation, the bankrupting of entire nations and the reduction of masses of human beings to hopeless poverty, the reckless destruction of the environment of the planet. Such are only the most obvious in a catalog of horrors unknown to even the darkest of ages past. Merely to mention them is to call to mind the divine warnings expressed in Baha'u'llah's words of a century ago. Quote, O heedless ones, though the wonders of my mercy have encompassed all created things, both visible and invisible, and though the revelations of my grace and bounty have permeated every atom of the universe, yet the rod with which I can chastise the wicked is grievous, and the fierceness of mine anger against them terrible. End quote. Shoghi Effendi, Advent of Divine Justice, page 81. Lest any observer of the cause be tempted to misunderstand such warnings as only metaphorical, Shoghi Effendi, drawing some of the historical implications, wrote in 1941, page 2, quote, A tempest unprecedented in its violence, unpredictable in its course, catastrophic in its immediate effects, unimaginably glorious in its ultimate consequences, is at present sweeping the face of the earth. Its driving power is remorselessly gaining in range and momentum. Its cleansing force, however much undetected, is increasing with every passing day. Humanity, gripped in the clutches of its devastating power, is smitten by the evidences of its resistless fury. It can neither perceive its origin, nor probe its significance, nor discern its outcome. Bewildered, agonized, and helpless, it watches this great and mighty wind of God invading the remotest and fairest regions of the earth, rocking its foundations, deranging its equilibrium, sundering its nations, disrupting the homes of its peoples, wasting its cities, driving into exile its kings, pulling down its bulwarks, uprooting its institutions, dimming its light, and harrowing up the souls of its inhabitants. End quote. Shoghi Effendi, The Promised Day Has Come, page 1. From the point of view of wealth and influence, the world of 1900 was Europe, and by grudging concession, the United States. Throughout the planet, Western imperialism was pursuing among the populations of other lands what it regarded as its civilizing mission. In the words of one historian, the century's opening decade appeared to be essentially a continuation of the long 19th century. Footnote, Eric Hobson, Age of Extremes, The Short 20th Century, 1914 to 1991, page 584, end footnote, appeared to be essentially a continuation of the long 19th century, an era whose boundless self-satisfaction was perhaps best epitomized by the celebration in 1897 of Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee, a parade that rolled for hours through the streets of London with an imperial panoply and display of military power far surpassing anything attempted in past civilizations. As the century began, there were few, whatever their degree of social or moral sensitivity, who perceived the catastrophes lying ahead, and few, if any, who could have conceived their magnitude. The military leadership of most European nations assumed that war of some kind would break out, but viewed the prospect with equanimity because of the twin fixed convictions that it would be short and would be won by their side. Page 3. To an extent, that seemed a little short of miraculous. The international peace movement was enlisting the support of statesmen, industrialists, scholars, the media, and influential personalities as unlikely as the Tsar of Russia. If the inordinate increase in armaments seemed ominous, the network of painstakingly crafted and often overlapping alliances seemed to give assurance that a general conflagration would be avoided and regional disputes settled, as they had been through most of the previous century. This illusion was reinforced by the fact that Europe's crowned heads, most of them members of one extended family and many of them exercising seemingly decisive political power, addressed one another familiarly by nicknames, carried on an intimate correspondence, married one another's sisters and daughters, and vacationed together throughout long stretches of each year at one another's castles, regattas, and shooting lodges. Even the painful disparities in the distribution of wealth were being energetically, if not very systematically, addressed in Western societies through legislation designed to restrain the worst of the corporate freebooting of preceding decades and to meet the most urgent demands of growing urban populations. The vast majority of the human family, living in lands outside the Western world, shared in few of the blessings and little of the optimism of their European and American brethren. China, despite its ancient civilization and its sense of itself as the Middle Kingdom, had become the hapless victim of plundering by Western nations and by its modernizing neighbor Japan. The multitudes in India, whose economy and political life had fallen so totally under the domination of a single imperial power as to exclude the usual jockeying for advantage, escaped some of the worst of the abuses afflicting other lands, but watched impotently as their desperately needed resources were drained away. The coming agony of Latin America was all too clearly prefigured in the suffering of Mexico, large sections of which had been annexed by its great northern neighbor, and whose natural resources were already attracting the attention of avaricious foreign corporations. particularly embarrassing from a Western point of view because of its proximity to such brilliant European capitals as Berlin and Vienna, was the medieval oppression in which the 100 million nominally liberated serfs in Russia led lives of sullen, hopeless misery. Most tragic of all was the plight of the inhabitants of the African continent, divided against one another by artificial boundaries created through cynical bargains among European powers. Page 4. It has been estimated during the first decade of the 20th century, over 1 million people in the Congo perished, starved, beaten, worked literally to death for the profit of their distant masters, a preview of the fate that was to engulf well over 100 million other fellow human beings across Europe and Asia before the century reached its end. Footnote. Leopold II, King of the Belgians, operated the colony as a private preserve for some 3 decades, 1877 to 1908. The atrocities carried out under his misrule aroused international protest, and in 1908 he was compelled to surrender the territory to the administration of the Belgian government. End of footnote. These masses of humankind, despoiled and scorned, but representing most of the Earth's inhabitants, were seen not as protagonists, but essentially as objects of the new century's much-wanted civilizing process. Despite benefits conferred on a minority among them, the colonial peoples existed chiefly to be acted upon, to be used, trained, exploited, Christianized, civilized, mobilized, as the shifting agendas of Western powers dictated. These agendas may have been harsh or mild in execution, enlightened or selfish, evangelical or exploitive, but were shaped by materialistic forces that determined both their means and most of their ends. To a large extent, religious and political pieties of various kinds masked both ends and means from the publics in the Western lands, who were thus able to derive moral satisfaction from the blessings their nations were assumed to be conferring on less worthy peoples, while themselves enjoying the material fruits of this benevolence. To point out the failings of a great civilization is not to deny its accomplishments. As the 20th century opened, the peoples of the West could take justifiable pride in the technological, scientific, and philosophical developments for which their societies had been responsible. Decades of experimentation had placed in their hands material means that were still beyond the appreciation of the rest of humanity. Throughout both Europe and America, vast industries had risen, dedicated to metallurgy, to the manufacturing of chemical products of every kind, to textiles, to construction, and to the production of instruments that enhanced every aspect of life. A continuous process of discovery, design, and improvement was making accessible power of unimaginable magnitude, with, alas, ecological consequences equally unimagined at the time, especially through the use of cheap fuel and electricity. Page 5. The era of the railroad was far advanced, and steamships coursed the seaways of the world. With the proliferation of telegraph and telephone communication, Western society anticipated the moment when it would be freed of the limiting effects that geographical distances had imposed on humankind since the dawn of history. Changes taking place at the deeper level of scientific thought were even far more reaching in their implications. The 19th century had still been held in the grip of the Newtonian view of the world as a vast clockwork system, but by the end of the century, the intellectual strides necessary to challenge that view had already been taken. New ideas were emerging that would lead to the formulation of quantum mechanics, and before long, the revolutionizing effect of the theory of relativity would call into question beliefs about the phenomenal world that had been accepted as common sense for centuries. Such breakthroughs were encouraged, and their influence greatly amplified by the fact that science had already changed from an activity of isolated thinkers to the systematically pursued concern of a large and influential international community, enjoying the amenities of universities, laboratories, and symposia for the exchange of experimental discoveries. Nor was the strength of Western societies limited to scientific and technological advances. As the 20th century opened, Western civilization was reaping the fruits of a philosophical culture that was rapidly liberating the energies of its populations, and whose influence would soon produce a revolutionary impact throughout the entire world. It was a culture which nurtured constitutional government, prized the rule of law, and respect for the rights of all society's members, and held up to the eyes of all it reached a vision of a coming age of social justice. If the boasts of liberty and equality that inflated patriotic rhetoric in Western lands were a far cry from conditions actually prevailing, Westerners could justly celebrate the advances toward those ideals that had been accomplished in the 19th century. From a spiritual perspective, the age was gripped by a strange paradoxical duality. In almost every direction, the intellectual horizon was darkened by clouds of superstition produced by unthinking imitation of earlier ages. 6. For most of the world's peoples, the consequences ranged from a profound ignorance about both human potentialities and the physical universe, to naive attachment to theologies that bore little or no relation to experience. Where winds of change did dispel the mists, among the educated classes in Western lands, inherited orthodoxies were all too often replaced by the blight of an aggressive secularism that called into doubt both the spiritual nature of humankind and the authority of moral values themselves. Everywhere, the secularization of society's upper levels seemed to go hand in hand with a pervasive religious obscurantism among the general population. At the deepest level, because of religion's influence reaches far into the human psyche and claims for itself a unique kind of authority, religious prejudices in all lands had kept alive in successive generations smoldering fires of bitter animosity that would fuel the horrors of the coming decades. Footnote. The processes that brought about these changes are reviewed in some detail by A. N. Wilson et al., God's Funeral, London, John Murray, 1999. In 1872, a book published by Winward Reed under the title The Martyrdom of Man, which became something of a secular Bible in the early decades of the 20th century, expressed the confidence that finally men will master the forces of nature. They will become themselves architects of systems, manufacturer of worlds. Man will then be perfect. He will then be a creator. He will therefore be what the vulgar worship as God. Cited by Anne Glynn Jones, Holding Up a Mirror, How Civilizations Decline, London, Century, 1996, pages 371 through 372. End of footnote. Page 7, Chapter 2. On this landscape of false confidence and deep despair, of scientific enlightenment and spiritual gloom, there appeared, as the 20th century opened, the luminous figure of Abdu'l-Bahá. The journey that had brought him to this pivotal moment in the history of humankind had led through more than 50 years of exile, imprisonment, and privation, hardly a month having passed in anything that resembled tranquility and ease. He came to it resolved to proclaim to responsive and heedless alike the establishment on earth of that promised reign of universal peace and justice that had sustained human hope throughout the centuries. Its foundation, he declared, would be the unification in this century of light of the world's peoples. Quote, "In this day, means of communication have multiplied, and the five continents of the earth have virtually merged into one. In like manner, all the members of the human family, whether peoples or governments, cities or villages, have become increasingly independent. Hence the unity of all mankind can in this day be achieved. Verily, this is none other but one of the wonders of this wondrous age, this glorious century." Footnote, selections from the writings of Abdu'l-Bahá, page 35. And footnote. Page 8. During the long years of imprisonment and banishment that followed Baha'u'llah's refusal to serve the political agenda of the Ottoman authorities, Abdu'l-Bahá was entrusted with the management of affairs, of faith's affairs, and with the responsibility of acting as his father's spokesman. A significant aspect of this work entailed interaction with local and provincial officials who sought his advice on the problems confronting them. Not dissimilar needs presented themselves in the master's homeland. As early as 1875, responding to Baha'u'llah's instructions, Abdu'l-Bahá addressed to the rulers and people of Persia a treatise entitled The Secret of Divine Civilization, setting out the spiritual principles that must guide the shaping of their society in the age of humanity's maturity. Its opening passage called upon the Iranian people to reflect on the lesson taught by history about the key to social progress. Quote, "Consider carefully all these highly varied phenomena, these concepts, this knowledge, these technical procedures and philosophical systems, these sciences, arts, industries, and inventions. All are emanations of the human mind. Whatever people has ventured deeper into this shoreless sea has come to excel the rest. The hapless and pride of a nation consist in this, that it should shine out like the sun in the high heaven of knowledge. Shall they who have knowledge and they who have it not be treated alike?" End quote. Footnote Abdu'l-Bahá, The Secret of Divine Civilization, page 2. End quote. Aaron, footnote. The Secret of Divine Civilization presaged the guidance that would flow from the pen of Abdu'l-Bahá in subsequent decades. After the devastating loss that followed the ascension of Baha'u'llah, the Persian believers were revived and heartened by a flood of tablets from the Master, which provided not only the spiritual sustenance they needed, but leadership in finding their way through the turmoil that was undermining the established order of things in their land. These communications, reaching even the smallest villages across the country, responded to the appeals and questions of countless individual believers, bringing guidance, encouragement, and assurance. We read, for example, a tablet addressing believers in the village of Kishi, mentioning by name nearly 160 of them. "Of the age now dawning, the Master says," page 9, this is the century of light, explaining that the meaning of this image is acceptance of the principle of oneness and implications. Quote, "My meaning is that the beloved of the Lord must regard every ill-wisher as a well-wisher, that is, they must associate with a foe as befitteth a friend, and deal with an oppressor as beseemeth a kind companion. They should not gaze upon the faults and transgressions of their foes, nor pay heed to their enmity, inequity, or oppression." End quote. Footnote, Makatib-e-Abdu'l-Bahá, Tablets of Abdu'l-Bahá, Volume 4, page 132 to 134, Provisional Translation. And footnote. Extraordinarily, the small company of persecuted believers living in this remote corner of a land which still remained largely unaffected by the developments taking place elsewhere in social and intellectual life are summoned by this tablet to raise their eyes above the level of local concerns and to see the implications of unity on a global scale. Quote, "Rather should they view the people in the light of the Blessed Beauty's call, that the entire human race are servants of the Lord of might and glory, as he hath brought the whole creation under the purview of his gracious utterance, and hath enjoined upon us to show forth love and affection, wisdom and compassion, faithfulness and unity towards all, without any discrimination." End footnote. End quote. Footnote, Ibid. End footnote. Here the call of the Master is not only to a new level of understanding, but implies the need for commitment and action. In the urgency and confidence of the language it employs, can be felt the power that would produce the great achievements of the Persian believers in the decades since then, both in the worldwide promotion of the cause and in the acquisition of capacities that advance civilization. Quotes, "O ye beloved of the Lord, with the utmost joy and gladness serve ye the human world, and love ye the human race. Turn your eyes away from limitations, and free yourselves from restrictions, for freedom therefrom brings about divine blessings and bestowals. Wherefore rest ye not, be it for an instant. Seek ye not a minute's respite, nor a moment's repose. Surge ye even as the billows of a mighty sea, and soar like unto the leviathan of the ocean of eternity." Page 10. Therefore, so long as there be a trace of life in one's veins, one must strive and labor and seek to lay a foundation that the passing of centuries and cycles may not undermine, and rear an edifice which the rolling of ages and eons cannot overthrow, an edifice that shall prove eternal and everlasting, so that the sovereignty of heart and soul may be established and secure in both worlds. End quotes. Footnote Ibid. End footnote. Social historians of the future, with a perspective far more dispassionate and universal than is presently possible, and benefiting from unimpeded access to all of the primary documentation, will study minutely the transformation that the Master achieved in these early years. Day after day, month after month, from a distant exile where he was endlessly harried by the host of enemies surrounding him, Abdu'l-Bahá was able not only to stimulate the expansion of the Persian Bahá'í community, but to shape its consciousness and collective life. The result was the emergence of a culture, however localized, that was unlike anything humanity had ever known. Our century, with all its upheavals and its grandiloquent claims to create a new order, has no comparable example of the systematic application of the powers of a single mind to the building of a distinctive and successful community that saw its ultimate sphere of work as the whole globe itself. Although suffering intermittent atrocities at the hands of the Muslim clergy and their supporters, without protection from a succession of indolent Qajar monarchs, the Persian Baha'i community found a new lease on life. The number of believers multiplied in all regions of the country. Persons prominent in the life of society were enrolled, including several influential members of the clergy, and the forerunners of administrative institutions emerged in the form of rudimentary consultative bodies. The importance of the latter development alone would be impossible to exaggerate. In a land and among a people accustomed for centuries to a patriarchal system that concentrated all decision-making authority in the hands of an absolute monarch or Shia mutajids, a community representing a cross-section of that society had broken with the past, taking into its own hands the responsibility for deciding its collective affairs through consultative action. Page 11. In the society and culture the Master was developing, spiritual energies expressed themselves in the practical affairs of day-to-day life. The emphasis in the teachings on education provided the impulse for the establishment of Baha'i schools, including the Tabarat School for Girls, which gained national renown in the capital as well as in provincial centers. Footnote on the School for the Girls. The school was closed in 1934 by order of Reza Shah because it had observed Baha'i holy days as religious holidays. The closing of all other Baha'i schools in Iran followed. And the footnote. With the assistance of American and European Baha'i helpers, clinics and other medical facilities followed. A network of couriers reaching across the land provided the struggling Baha'i community with the rudiments of the postal service that the rest of the country so conspicuously lacked. The changes underway touched the homeliest circumstances of day-to-day life. In obedience to the laws of the Kitab-i Aqdas, for example, Persian Baha'is abandoned the use of the filthy public baths, prolific in their spread of infection and disease, and began to rely on showers that used fresh water. All of these advances, whether social, organizational, or practical, owe their driving force to the moral transformation taking place among the believers, a transformation that was steadily distinguishing Baha'is, even in the eyes of those hostile to the faith, as candidates for positions of trust. That such far-reaching changes could so quickly set one segment of the Persian population apart from the largely antagonistic majority around it was a demonstration of the powers released by Baha'u'llah's covenant with his followers and by Abdu'l-Bahá's assumption of the leadership of this covenant invested uniquely in him. Throughout these years, Persian political life was in almost constant turmoil. While Nasruddin Shah's immediate successor, Muzaffarid Din Shah, was induced to approve a constitution in 1906, his successor, Muhammad Ali Shah, recklessly dissolved the first two parliaments, in one case attacking with cannon fire the building where the legislature was meeting. the so-called constitutional movement that overthrew him and compelled the last of the Qajar kings, Ahmad Shah, to summon a third parliament, was itself riven by competing factions and shamelessly manipulated by the Shia clergy. Efforts by Baha'is to play a constructive role in this process of modernization was repeatedly frustrated by royalists and popular factions alike, both of which were inspired by the prevailing religious prejudice and saw in the Baha'i community merely a convenient scapegoat. Page 12. Here again, only a more politically mature age than our own will be able to appreciate the way in which the Master, setting an example for future challenges that the Baha'i community must inevitably encounter, guided that beleaguered community in doing all it could to encourage political reform, and then in being willing to step aside when these efforts were cynically rebuffed. It was not only through his tablets that Abdu'l-Bahá exercised this influence on the rapidly developing Baha'i community and the cradle of the faith. Unlike Westerners, Persian believers were not distinguished from other peoples of the Near East by dress and appearance, and so travelers from the cradle of the faith did not arouse suspicion of the Ottoman authorities. Consequently, a steady stream of Persian pilgrims provided Abdu'l-Bahá with another powerful means of inspiring the friends, guiding their activities, and drawing them ever more deeply into an understanding of Baha'u'llah's purpose. Some of the greatest names in Persian Baha'i history were among those who journeyed to Akka and returned to their homes, prepared to give their lives, if necessary, for the achievement of the Master's vision. The immortal Varka and his son Ruhollah were among these privileged number, as were Haji Mirza Hader Ali, Mirza Abdul Fadl, Mirza Muhammad Taqi Afnan, and four distinguished hands of the cause, Ibn E. Akbar, Haji Mullah Ali Akbar, Adibullah Ulma, and Ibn E. Azdak. The spirit that today sustains Persian pioneers in every part of the world, and that plays so creative a role in the building of the Baha'i community life, runs like a straight line through family after family back to those heroic days. In retrospect, it is apparent that the phenomenon we today know as the twin processes of expansion and consolidation itself had its origin in those marvelous years. Inspired by the Master's words and the accounts brought back from the Holy Land, Persian believers arose to undertake travel teaching activities in the Far East. During the latter years of Baha'u'llah's ministries, communities had been established in Burma, India, and Burma, and the faith carried as far as China, and this work was now reinforced. A demonstration of the new powers released in the cause was the erection in the Russian province of Turkestan, where a vigorous Baha'i community life has also developed, of the first Baha'i house of worship in the world. Page 13. A project inspired by the Master and guided from its inception by his advice. Footnote on the Baha'i house of worship. See the Baha'i World Volume 14, pages 479-481 for the history. And footnote. It was this broad range of activities carried out by an increasingly confident body of believers and stretching from the Mediterranean to the China Sea that built the base of support from which Abdu'l-Bahá was able to pursue the promising opportunities which, as the new century opened, had already begun to unfold in the West. Not the least important feature of this base was its embrace of representatives of the Orient's great diversity of racial, religious, and national backgrounds. This achievement provided Abdu'l-Bahá with the examples on which he would repeatedly draw in his proclamation to Western audiences of the integrating forces that had been released through Baha'u'llah's advent. The greatest victory of these early years was the Master's success in constructing on Mount Carmel, on the spot designated for it by Baha'u'llah and through immense effort, a mausoleum for the remains of the Bab, which had been brought at great risk and difficulty to the Holy Land. Shoghi Effendi has explained that whereas in past ages the blood of martyrs was the seed of personal faith, in this day it has constituted the seed of the administrative institutions of the cause. Footnote. Shoghi Effendi, The World Order of Baha'u'llah, page 156. And footnote. Such an insight lends special meaning to the way in which the administrative center of Baha'u'llah's world order would take shape under the shadow of the shrine of the faith's martyr prophet. Shoghi Effendi sets the master's achievement in global and historical perspective. Quote, "For just as in the realm of the spirit, the reality of the Bab has been hailed by the author of the Baha'i revelation as the point round whom the realities of the prophets and messengers revolve, so on this visible plane, his sacred remains constitute the heart and center of what may be regarded as nine concentric circles, paralleling thereby and adding further emphasis to the central position accorded by the founder of our faith to one whom God hath caused to precede the knowledge of all that was and shall be, the primal point from which have been generated all created things." End of quote. There's a footnote on what may be regarded as nine concentric circles. The outermost circle in this vast system, the visible counterpart of the pivotal position conferred on the herald of our faith, is none other than the entire planet. Within the heart of this planet lies the most holy land, acclaimed by Abdu'l-Bahá as the nest of the prophets, and which must be regarded as the center of the world and the Qibli of the nations. Within this most holy land rises the mountain of God of immemorable sanctity, the vineyard of the Lord, the retreat of Elijah, whose return the Bab himself symbolizes. Reposing on the breast of this holy mountain are the extensive properties permanently dedicated to and constituting the sacred precincts of the Bab's holy sepulchre. In the midst of these properties, recognized as the international endowments of the faith, is situated the most holy court, an enclosure comprising gardens and terraces which at once embellish and lend a peculiar charm to these sacred precincts. Embosomed in these lovely and verdant surroundings stands in all its exquisite beauty the mausoleum of the Bab, the shell designed to preserve and adorn the original structure raised by Abdu'l-Bahá as the tomb of the martyr herald of our faith. Within this shell is enshrined that pearl of great price, the Holy of Holies, those chambers which constitute the tomb itself, and which were constructed by Abdu'l-Bahá. Within the heart of this Holy of Holies is the tabernacle, the vault wherein reposes the most holy casket. Within this vault rests the alabaster sarcophagus, in which is deposited that inestimable jewel, the Bab's holy dust. Shoghi Effendi, Citadel of Faith, page 95 and 96. And then the quotation that was just read, that was also from page 95 of the same book. And the footnote. The significance in Abdu'l-Bahá's own eyes of the mission he had accomplished at such cost is movingly depicted by Shoghi Effendi. Page 14. Quote, "When all was finished and the earthly remains of the martyr prophet of Shiraz were at long last safely deposited for their everlasting rest in the bosom of God's holy mountain, Abdu'l-Bahá, who had cast aside his turban, removed his shoes and thrown off his cloak, bent low over the still open sarcophagus, his silver hair waving about his head and his face transfigured and luminous, rested his forehead on the border of the wooden casket and, sobbing aloud, wept with such a weeping that all those who were present wept with him. That night he could not sleep, so overwhelmed was he with emotion." End of quote. Shoghi Effendi, God Passes By, page 276. And footnote. By 1906, the so-called Young Turk Revolution had freed not only most of the Ottoman Empire's political prisoners, but Abdu'l-Bahá as well. Suddenly, the restraints that had kept him confined to the prison city of Akka and its immediate surroundings had fallen away, and the master was in a position to proceed with an enterprise that Shoghi Effendi was later to describe as one of the three principal achievements of his ministry: his public proclamation of the cause of God in the great population centers of the Western world. Because of the dramatic character of the events that occurred in North America and Europe, accounts of the master's historic journeys sometimes tend to overlook the important opening year spent in Egypt. Abdu'l-Bahá arrived there in September 1910, intending to go on directly to Europe, but was compelled by illness to remain in residence at Ramla, a suburb of Alexandria, until August of the following year. As it turned out, the months that followed were a period of great productivity whose full effects on the fortunes of the cause, in the African continent especially, will be felt for many years to come. To some extent, the way had no doubt been paved by warm admiration for the master on the part of Sheikh Muhammad Abdu, who had met him on several occasions in Beirut, and who subsequently became Mufti of Egypt and a leading figure at Al-Azhar University. Page 15. An aspect of the Egyptian sojourn that deserves special attention was the opportunity it provided for the first public proclamation of the faith's message. The relatively cosmopolitan and liberal atmosphere prevailing in Cairo and Alexandria at the time opened a way for frank and searching discussions between the master and prominent figures in the intellectual world of Sunni Islam. These included clerics, parliamentarians, administrators, and aristocrats. Further, editors and journals from influential Arabic language newspapers whose information about the cause had been colored by prejudiced reports emanating from Persian and Constantinople now had an opportunity to learn the facts of the situation for themselves. Publications that had been openly hostile changed their tone. The editors of one such newspaper opened an article on the master's arrival by referring to, quote, His Eminence Mirza Abbas Effendi, the learned and erudite head of the Baha'is in Akka and the center of authority for Baha'is throughout the world, and expressing appreciation, end quote, and expressing appreciation for his visit to Alexandria. Footnote, H.M. al-Bayuzi, Abdul Baha, The Center of the Covenant of Baha'u'llah, 2nd edition, page 136, and footnote. This and other articles paid particular tribute to Abdul Baha's understanding of Islam and to the principles of unity and religious tolerance that lay at the heart of his teachings. Despite the master's ill health that had caused it, the Egyptian interlude proved to be a great blessing. Western diplomats and officials were able to observe at first hand the extraordinary success of Abdul Baha's interaction with leading figures in a region of the Near East that was of lively interest in European circles. Accordingly, by the time the master embarked from Marseille on 11 August 1911, his fame had preceded him. This is the end of side one. Please stop the tape, turn it over, and continue on side two.